Good afternoon. I'm Nicholas Komnenos, President and Professor at InMed, the Institute for International Medicine. And part of my role as an instructor at InMed is both lecturing in courses, but also guiding our learners in precepted service experiences. And one of the most popular sites for those precepted experiences is at the Baptist Medical Center in Ghana, right on the northern border with the Sahara Desert. Who has been to BMC before? Oh, but you will want to, because at BMC we deliver 20 to 30 babies every single day. Now, this is one of the most low-resource regions of the entire world. If you look at people's incomes, you'll see that northern Ghana, Burkina Faso, is extremely, extremely poor. So I was at BMC a couple of years ago, and I was precepting our InMed learners. And there arrived a young Ghanaian physician, Okinko. And Okinko was assigned to do his required 2 years of public service at the Baptist Med Center. And Okinko came to me one afternoon and he said, "Oh, Dr. Nicholas, this woman is in labor, this woman is in labor, but the baby won't come, the baby won't come." And I said, "Well, Okinko, let's go examine this woman." And so we go there, and she is about 4.5 feet tall. But she has a very term-sized uterus, and I put my hand on the uterus, and indeed, she is contracting every couple of minutes, pretty strong. But on vaginal exam, the baby's head was very high. And so I said to Okinko, "Well, let's let her labor for another couple of hours, and let's see if she's made any progress." And so a couple of hours later, Okinko returns and he says, "Oh, Dr. Nicholas, this woman is in labor, but the baby won't come. The baby won't come." And so I examined the woman once again, and indeed she was still having very strong contractions, and the baby's head was still very high, really no progress. And so I said to Okinko, "What do you think we should do?" I paused. A pregnant pause. And he replied, "Oh, you must do a cesarean section. Save this woman. Save this baby." And I paused. And I said, "Well, Okinko, I think you should do the cesarean." Oh, his eyes got so big. "I've never seen this surgery before." And I said, "Well, Okinko, I'm here for 3 more weeks. And then who's the doctor going to be?" And oh, he looked around. And suddenly he realized that he was going to be the only doctor. So we went to the operating room and I walked him through his first cesarean. And the baby came out great. Mom was doing great. And we spent those next 3 weeks not only doing cesareans, but more importantly, working through how to manage these complicated obstetric challenges. Now, you're here because you have an interest in this kind of skill set, and maybe even sharing your skills with others. And so let's begin with a Haitian proverb. "I'm going to sea to catch a baby, but the journey is long and dangerous, and I may not return." Now, what is being expressed in this poem? What do you see? Fear of death. Rooted in what? Delivering a baby because maybe someone else died. Yeah, exactly. That's right. Well, there has been a lot of progress, actually, in maternal survival over the last century. And what I want to do in the next few slides is show you that progress. And we're going to look at it using a graphic. On the bottom is income. And it's a log. And so there's $400 a month, I'm sorry, per year, $4,000 a year, $40,000 a year. And then on the vertical axis is maternal death. And it's also a log. So there's 10, deaths per 100,000, 100 deaths per 100,000 births, 1,000 deaths per 100,000 births. And then the colors of the bubbles represent the countries, and the size of the bubble is the size of the country. And so here we are in 1900. India has high mortality and low income, the upper left corner, and Europe in the brown is not much better off, a little higher income, a little lower mortality, but not by much. So there's 1900, and then 1950. Now, someone tell me, what change did you see between 1900 and 1950? It went down. The death went down. And what happened to income? Income went up, generally. And they did correlate. That's right. All right, now let's look what happened. 1960, 1970. What do you see? 1950 through 1970. Yeah. Decreased mortality, increased income, especially in Europe and America's in the yellow. Well, now in 1980, we suddenly get a lot more data. In the blue, the bright blue, we have Southern Africa. And in the green, we have Northern Africa. So a lot more data points. Now look what happened. 1980, 1990, 2000, 2011. What happened? Not much. There's 1980, 1990, 2000, 2011. What happened to maternal mortality in Southern Africa, in the blue? Essentially, no significant advance. Now, Northern Africa, generally a little bit better. Who's familiar with the Sustainable Development Goals? You've heard of the Sustainable Development? All right, some of you. So this is a worldwide undertaking by health associations to improve people's health by addressing these 17 goal areas. Now, look at these, and I want to ask you how many of them have something to do with the health of pregnant women or their newborns? So I hear 5, 9, 10, most all of them, maybe life under the sea, not so much, but most of these worldwide health development goals have a positive impact on the health of pregnant women and their newborns. Here's a question for you. Pregnancy is associated with major health risks. Which one of these is not a major cause of maternal deaths? Which one is not a major cause of maternal death? I'll give you a hint. What kills women at the time of delivery is the very same in Indiana as it is in India. It's the same causes, it's just different frequency. So which one doesn't fit? It's D, deep venous thrombosis. Now, it does happen in pregnancy, but it usually does not lead to death. The corollary to that question is, what are the leading causes of maternal death worldwide? Now, this is important because if we want to make a positive impact on the health of these mothers and these newborns, then this is what we need to address. So what are these top four or five causes of maternal death?
Hemorrhage.
Preeclampsia. Infection or sepsis. Ruptured uterus, yes. Fortunately, that's not very common. Obstructed labor or failure to progress for whatever reason. You know, whether it's because the baby is too big or the contractions are too light, but failure to progress. And so this is what the causes look like. About a quarter of them are due to postpartum hemorrhage. So baby's out, and the woman starts bleeding. Another 20% are what we sometimes call hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, the spectrum of preeclampsia to eclampsia. And then there at 6 o'clock is the failure to progress, the obstructed labor causes. Almost a quarter are due to sepsis, due to infection around the time of delivery. Either they rupture their membranes and then they become infected, or they deliver their baby and later on become infected. And then up there between 10 p.m. and midnight are things like anemia and malaria, sometimes exacerbation of underlying health problems. They had this problem before they were pregnant, and then it got a lot worse. What kind of diseases get a lot worse when you're pregnant? Think of some organ systems that are especially stressed during pregnancy. Heart. And so women who have valvular heart disease from rheumatic fever, which is still an enormous problem throughout the low-income world. Kidney disease. The other organ system that I'm mainly thinking of here is respiratory. Pulmonary. So a woman who has bad asthma, who has COPD from breathing smoking fire smoke, then their residual lung capacity is significantly reduced because of pregnancy, because they have a gravid uterus pressing up on their lungs. And so their disease may get much worse during pregnancy. What about the risk of pregnant women who get a malaria infection? What does malaria do to pregnant women? Not so bad. Easy recovery. Death. Now, yeah, I did hear anemia, and of course, anemia is a real significant comorbidity for bad obstetric outcome. But malaria in pregnancy is often fatal. Pregnant women are extraordinarily sensitive to death from malaria. Even women who have lived in that environment and have suffered malaria a dozen times before, and they have some antibody resistance because of that, if they get pregnant, then they're much more likely to have complications. Now, there are certain women who are at especially high risk for a poor outcome. Why do we want to know who those women are? Why do we want to know? Prevention. Yeah, so these are people who may need some special attention to increase their survival. Who are these women? What women come to mind as being especially high risk for poor outcome?
Very young.
Very young. Very malnourished. Very old.
Multiple pregnancies.
First pregnancies. Those who have comorbidities, yeah, the person with valvular heart disease, for example.
No prenatal care.
Yeah, no prenatal care. And so in broad strokes, we especially want to give care to first-time mothers, to those who have chronic diseases, to those who are older. Those who are in poor health to start with are, of course, going to be much more likely to suffer some complication from their pregnancy. So let's turn it around. Oh, here we go. All of the following health risks are associated with a short interval between birth, except which one? Now, what do I mean by short interval? She delivers her baby. She gets pregnant 6 weeks later. And then she delivers another baby, all within one calendar year. So those babies are born really close together. And all of these are potential complications of that short interval, except which one? It's herd immunity is what I'm looking for. That's right. So if indeed all the siblings are vaccinated, you know, they all have got their measles vaccine or their hepatitis B vaccine, then there's less likely to be transmission within the family. But certainly low birth weight and complications, nutritional complications associated with stopping breastfeeding, because now you have another baby that you need to breastfeed, you know, are potential bad outcomes. Now, who are those newborns who are at especially high risk? You know, which newborns do we want to provide special attention? I hear too small, too big, too early. What else comes to mind? Infants of diabetic mothers who tend to be large and hypoglycemic. A mother who's already died. Excellent. Those with disability, those mothers who have a disability to start with, those newborns who have a disability to start with, the children who have disabilities. Yeah. Probably the number one risk, if you look at large numbers of newborns, is being born too early. So if she's born too early, then of course there's respiratory distress and there's low birth weight often. And so in light of this dangerous pattern, what can we possibly do? Keep the baby in longer. Yes, that's a very, very succinct. And keeping the baby in longer, keeping the woman gravid until at least 35 weeks or so, involves what usually what kind of actions can we take in order to accomplish that goal?
Prenatal care, education.
Adequate caloric intake for the mother. Nutrition. So let's talk for a second about the prenatal care piece of this. So you're seeing a woman in her third trimester of pregnancy for a routine prenatal appointment. What kind of things do you want to evaluate her for that could potentially prevent her from going into early labor?
Her weight.
Poor weight gain.
And increased weight,
which could be a sign of, you said it.
Yeah. She had edema and hypertension.
And so you have a third trimester pregnant woman who has hypertension, weight gain, and peripheral edema. She probably is suffering from preeclampsia. Right. And so managing her preeclampsia, hopefully, will prevent her from going into labor early. Or at least you'll be prepared for that preterm baby birth. All right, so those are some of the things that you, the clinician, can do during prenatal care in order to evaluate and manage these complications. Now, what are some education points that you'd want to take advantage of this opportunity to explain to her certain things that may improve her outcome? Now, we talked about nutrition. What else could we talk to her about? Warning signs. What would be some warning signs? If you have any of this happen, then you should come right back.
Swelling.
Headaches.
Bleeding.
Contractions. Yes, definitely.
Bleeding.
Ruptured membranes. Now, this sounds elementary to a lot of us, but for a first or second or even third time new mother, it needs to be said every single time we see them, so that if any of these warning signs happen, then you need to return immediately. Now, up to this point, in the last 20 minutes, we've talked about problems. What I want to do right now is turn our attention to what has been done, what is being done, that is especially useful. And so when you see this question, what are the most effective interventions? What comes to mind?
Vaccinations.
Prenatal care.
Education.
Blood pressure, urine protein.
Good water. Adequate diet. Not too young. That might be too late.
All right. Well, I want to answer this question in two pieces. First, I want to talk about contraception. And then we're going to talk about interventions at the time of delivery. Now, I spent most of my career in Angola, a nation in southern Africa. You all know where Angola is, don't you? Not all of you, but you would like to know. So when you look at a map of Africa, Africa looks like this. So up here we've got the Sahara Desert, and Ghana is the bicep, and Kenya is the left hand, and Angola is the right knee of the continent of Africa. Now in Angola, most women still have 6 to 8 children. And when I would talk with them individually, they would say, I really hope that my daughters don't have to have so many kids. You know, I would really prefer to have a smaller family size. Why is that? What are some benefits of a smaller family?
More resources.
More resources.
Less stress.
Healthier moms. Healthier kids. Less stress on the family finances.
More bonding time.
More bonding time.
Better relationship with the spouse.
Better relationship with the spouse. Okay.
Fewer stays on clothes.
Yeah. What's that?
I said fewer stains on clothes.
Fewer stains on the clothes. Yes. Someone speaking from experience. And so we know from the data that the health of the mother is usually better. Every pregnancy is associated with a certain amount of risk. And so, and it's multiplicative. And so if a woman delivers 6 or 7 kids, then her risk is twice as high of a bad complication compared to a woman who delivers 3 or 4 kids. Similarly, we know from the data that newborns tend to be healthier when they are born within smaller families. And a lot of that has to do with the resources that you all mentioned a moment ago. It's important, of course, that this question be addressed within the culture. You know, I was trying to be very, very sensitive to my Angolan counterparts. Eu vou dizer-lhes que eu sou americano. Não sei nada acerca desta cultura. I'm an American. I just don't know anything about your culture, you know. So what do you think? And what are your desires? And then usually when we ask open questions like that, they'll answer it correctly themselves. And then, of course, they'll own it because they have done so. Now, if the objective of these women is to have a smaller family, how can that be accomplished in the future? Education of whom?
Well, of all which, but of every year of education that the woman stays in school is helpful.
Yep.
But also for the men, if you can get them engaged in the conversation, would be awesome.
So every year that the woman stays in school is probably a year that she is not reproducing, and if you can get the men involved as well, then that can reinforce the movement. What else can be done? Contraception, yes. Okay, education on methods, on contraception methods. One of the most fascinating improvements in maternal health happened in Bangladesh about 30 years ago. Some of you are old enough to remember when all of our clothing was made in Bangladesh. And what the companies did was they went in, they built factories, they hired thousands of young, adolescent Bangladeshi women, and they paid them a wage. And so these women suddenly had a degree of independence that they didn't before. They had financial resources, they had some control of their lives, and they delayed marriage, and they had fewer children. Now, since then, of course, the garment industry has moved elsewhere, but the principle is that employment opportunities can have a really powerful impact on the on the health and the livelihood and the maternal newborn status of such low-income women. One of you mentioned contraception. We should provide contraception or make it available so that they can reduce their family size. What sort of objections have you heard?
Religion.
My husband doesn't want me to do this.
Financial.
It'll hurt my future fertility, yes. I don't have access to contraception. Is it an abortifacient? I'll gain weight. The education level of the woman may make it difficult to understand the use of the contraceptive. The government's trying to control our numbers. Now, these are objections that I hear everywhere in the world. You know, I hear this in the U.S., I hear this in China, I hear this in Angola. So, ubiquitous concerns about the potential side effects of contraception. Probably the most ubiquitous is that if I use this contraception, will I ever be able to get pregnant? You know. And so that concern about future fertility is front and center. And then in a lot of cultures, it's the mother-in-law who is actually making decisions, you know, who is deciding how many children will be born by the bride who was purchased by the husband. And so our intimate understanding of the culture and values of the people we want to serve is going to be critical in order to help guide them in making decisions. What is the one best method of contraception?
None of these, so E.
Okay, this is kind of a trick question, but there is no one best method of contraception. And several of you said abstinence. Yeah, totally with you on that. But we as the healthcare professional need to be familiar with the pros and cons of all of the commonly used contraception methods so that we can counsel people appropriately as to what might be best, you know, given their particular setting. No perfect. Now, at the same time, we're talking with young, fertile women about contraception. We could also use that teachable moment or that little clinical encounter to address other important health issues that affect younger women. Like what?
Are you talking about sexually active?
You're talking sexually, about yeah, we're talking
STDs.
Sexually active.
STDs.
Okay, STDs.
STIs, whatever.
Domestic violence. Menstrual health. Prenatal care.
Breastfeeding and general nutrition.
Breastfeeding and general nutrition.
Cervical cancer.
Cervical cancer screening, breast cancer screening. Now, often these women have very little access to professional health care. And so when we do have an opportunity with them, then we may want to say what else is really important for this particular person while we have them for 5 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour to address as well so that we can really take advantage of that opportunity with them. Now, the second powerful opportunity to improve health is at the time of delivery or shortly before. Because this is when most of the lethal complications happen. I want you to imagine for a moment that you have been invited to a low-resource community to start a birthing center. They want you to come and help their women deliver healthy babies and stop all of these maternal deaths. Who is a health professional? Hey, most of you, and most of you have done an obstetrics experience. And you did it at a very high-level hospital. You know, they have a modern OB delivery suite. They have got an operating room right next door, and they've got the trained staff, and the pharmacy is right there. And so when we go into those kind of learning environments, then we're learning our little role, but it's supported by this wonderful infrastructure. Now, if you're going to help this community start a birthing center from scratch, you don't have any of that. And you probably don't have much of a budget either. And so my question is, what are the most important elements of care that you would want to provide when starting a birthing center?
Clean environment.
Clean environment.
Why a birthing center?
Well, in this case, they don't have any healthcare resources, but their interest is in delivering healthy babies. Yeah.
Recognizing a problem.
Okay, the ability to recognize a complication.
Educating the local midwife. Because you've got to train birth attendants versus one. You're not going to have the midwife that's gone to school 4 years or whatever. It's going to be probably local midwives to begin with. But you want to make sure that the knowledge base is there. Somebody comes in, train them.
Make sure that you have got trained people who are going to be providing the care.
Right.
And maybe that starts with local midwives. Is it a safe place to deliver?
A source of light.
A source of light, yes. Light, electricity. We're not taking anything for granted here.
Some method of fetal monitoring.
I mean, this list could get kind of long, you know. If someone comes in labor and you need to be able to assess them and check their blood pressure and monitor the progress of their labor. As you mentioned, we're going to want to be aware of the potential complications and be able to step in and intervene if she has a postpartum hemorrhage or failure to progress. Provide care for that newborn. And what if that newborn doesn't breathe when it delivers? I hear a call out for helping babies breathe team.
Keeping them warm.
Now, this is a daunting undertaking to say that we're going to start delivering babies and we're going to do it in a way that is safe. But you need to have a starting point. And so this gives us some place to begin. Now, we certainly don't want anyone to die when they are at our new birthing center. And so we're going to be especially prepared for the one leading cause of maternal death, which is
hemorrhage.
A quarter of all of these deaths due to hemorrhage. So as a resident physician in Fort Worth, I delivered a woman, and her baby came out screaming, and I dried off the baby, and I set it on top of the mom, and I looked back, and there was a river of blood pouring out of her vagina. What could possibly cause that? Okay, I hear uterine atonia. The uterine isn't clamping. What else? Retained placenta, which keeps the uterus from clamping down all the way. So the uterus is a muscle. And if there's still placenta inside, then it's not going to be able to completely contract and it's going to bleed. I heard trauma. So think about the birth canal for a second. All right, cervix, vagina, labia majora. A laceration anywhere along that route is going to bleed, especially a laceration of what? A cervix. So some of you have seen a pregnant cervix before. It's very engorged. It's usually purple and it's really large. And you can imagine how the baby's head tearing that cervix could lead to a torrent of bleeding. Who's familiar with the four T's? Yeah, several of you are smiling. So this is a useful way to remember the causes of postpartum hemorrhage. So T is for tone. That's the uterine tone. It's not contracting. T is for a tear. especially of the cervix, which is most likely to bleed. Tissue, that is the placenta, which is still inside the uterus, so the uterus can't contract. And then a very rare cause is a coagulopathy, for which we use the term T for thrombin. And so I was looking at this river of blood pouring from her vagina, and of course I thought of the four T's, but I need some way to actually assess the information so I would know which of the T's is causing her bleeding. So what's the first thing I could do to assess what's causing this woman's hemorrhage? Okay, I hear, put your hand on the uterus. That's right. So I'm going to put one hand on the uterus, and what am I feeling for?
Firmness.
Is it firm or is it soft? So a soft uterus, probably not clamping down, maybe that's the cause. A rock-hard uterus, maybe that's not the cause because it is solid, all right? What's the next thing I could do? I'm going to exam for trauma. So I need to examine her birth canal to identify something bleeding. I'm going to need a little equipment to do that. What do I need?
A speculum, a light.
A speculum, a light. Gauze, suction. You're especially going to need a light. An assistant. Yes, to help you expose the cause. And then check the placenta. So this woman has already delivered, and if her placenta is out, then we're going to look at it and see if maybe a piece of it's missing. And then if there is still blood pouring from the uterus, then you just take your gloved hand and you go through the vagina, through the cervix, into the uterus. Now, a baby just came out of there, right? There's still space for a few minutes. And then you're going to feel for something that feels like placenta, and if you do so, you're going to pull it out. What does a placenta feel like? Like hamburger, right? It's gelatinous and soft. And so if you feel anything in there that's gelatinous and soft, you're going to grab it and extract. Now, I mentioned coagulopathy or a bleeding disorder. How would you quickly know if it's possibly a bleeding disorder? Is she bleeding in other places? Yes. Has she bled before? If there's clots, yeah, exactly. So whenever someone bleeds, within 30 seconds or so, it starts to clot. And so if you see that blood on the floor is not coagulating, that's pretty strong evidence that there may be a bleeding disorder. Well, in the case of this woman I delivered in Fort Worth, she did indeed have a boggy uterus, and there was no laceration on exam. And so, what is first aid for uterine apnea?
Massage.
Okay, I hear several people say massage. What's the correct way to massage the uterus?
Circular, pushing down,
plus? What's underneath the uterus? You know, think of a woman laying supine. She has her uterus, and behind her uterus is
bowel.
Yeah, basically. And so, if all you do is press down from above, then you're just pushing the uterus into the bowel, or maybe into the spine. What you need is something firm behind. And so, putting your other hand in the uterus. In the vagina, like a fist, and then pushing down from the top, now you have got direct pressure from both sides on the uterus. Now, this is just basic first aid, right? Someone who is bleeding needs to have pressure applied to the bleeding point to stop it from bleeding. And while you're holding that in position, you need some drugs. What drugs are especially effective for apnea?
Pitocin.
Methergen, Cytotec, Hemabate, so we live in an age when we got some wonderful drugs. Now, in the United States, when someone delivers their baby, they basically all get oxytocin unless they refuse. And then on top of that, we have got several different prostaglandin drugs, like misoprostol, that can be given to cause uterine contractions. Methergen is a drug that's been around for decades and pretty effective. And then there are IV medications like tranexamic acid that can cause coagulation. Your birthing center, think you should have some of this available? Yeah, definitely. So in Angola, we have got kits for midwives. And, of course, our resources are low. And what we provide in the kit is misoprostol. It's inexpensive. It's easy to use. It's easy to instruct our midwives how to use it. You know, and it's life-saving in that context. In chronological order, the steps to manage postpartum hemorrhage are what? All right, I hear a C. That's right. So first we're going to check for atony, because that's really easy and fast. And then we're going to look for laceration. And then we're going to explore the uterus for retained placenta, if necessary. And then later, once we have identified the cause, then we'll repair a laceration, if that's what it really was. Right. Now, up to this point, we've been talking about the mother. Let's turn our attention for a moment to the baby. Take a look at this kid. So I mentioned delivering babies in Ghana, and there was a woman who was delivering her fifth or sixth child, and the baby delivered, and the baby looked like this. And the midwife was holding the baby, and she came up to the woman, and she says, "Oh, so sorry, dead baby." And she set the baby down on the table. Was that a dead baby? What was up with that baby? Why was that baby floppy and purple and not breathing? Primary apnea. About 10% of newborn babies around the globe look like this when they're born. They do not spontaneously start crying and moving and breathing. And so what does this baby need? What's the intervention? Suction, stimulation. What else do I hear? Positive pressure ventilation. And so fortunately, there was a nursing student, actually from the capital city, who was there doing her obstetrics rotation, and she just went right up to the baby and picked it up and started drying it off. And the baby started crying. It was like, "Why are you bothering me?" And so everybody in the room, especially the mother, just let out a, "Oh, wonderful." Some of you are familiar with helping babies breathe. Raise your hands. Who knows HBB? HBB has a new name now. The WHO is calling it ENC1, that is Essential Newborn Care 1. Essential Newborn Care 2 is actually routine newborn care following delivery, but 1. So they're meant to be a series, 1 followed by 2. But HBB, or Essential Newborn Care 1, is one of the most effective things that you can teach traditional midwives or young nurses or whoever is delivering the babies. And the elements of HBB are those that we just talked about. You dry the baby, you assess the baby, you stimulate the baby, you suction the baby, and if necessary, you apply positive pressure ventilation. The data on HBB is very encouraging. This is a skill set that you could easily transfer to the people that you want to serve. And you can reinforce it when you go back and serve those people again to help these kids survive. A lot of my role today is involved with teaching these kind of skills. If you're interested in learning a little bit about that, you can scan me and I'd be happy to share with you some upcoming HBB courses and routine newborn care courses and complicated obstetrics courses just as an opportunity to reinforce your own skill set. The idea, of course, is not simply to keep that for yourself, but then to transfer that skill to other people so that they will be able to care for their own moving forward. Now, I'm going to finish in just a moment, and I want you to be thinking about your vision for maternal newborn health. How does that fit into your vision of service? Or how could it potentially fit into your vision moving forward? I want to share with you a 3-minute video about a birthing center, just like the one we talked about a few minutes earlier, where some midwives came to a very impoverished neighborhood in the Philippines and started a birthing home called Mercy in Action. And then I want to open up the conversation and ask you, what sort of vision do you have for this providing this kind of care?
Ready to live.
So what kind of vision comes to mind for you about maternal newborn care moving forward? We're trying to get our people to understand the value of this kind of care. Who are your people?
In Eastern Uganda.
Eastern Uganda. Yeah.
Trying to get rid of the barriers to
trying to get rid of the barriers to this kind
proper
of care,
prenatal.
Proper prenatal. So in your setting, what are those main barriers that you deal with?
Access to health care, access to prenatal care. There's a lot of transportation issues.
Okay, access to health care, prenatal care, transportation issues.
And just a lack of knowledge of the importance of prenatal care.
Yeah, just a lack of knowledge about the importance of prenatal care. Yes? Midwives at the Edges,
right.
New ministry.
So that's networking midwives globally that are especially working in unreached people group areas.
Networking midwives globally who are working in unreached people areas.
Right. Yep. So our director is Carrie Blake. She's a midwife. And if you want any kind of information on that, we have. You can go to a booth. It's called the Christian Global Health in Perspective.
Christian Global Health in Perspective booth.
You have some little handouts there.
Some handouts there to pick up.
It's not a QR code, but you can get more information.
Okay, Christian.
If you want to talk to me, you can talk to me.
What's your name?
Mike.
Sutherland. Okay, talk to Mike Sutherland. Excellent, thank you. And are you on the second floor or the first floor? Second floor, great. What else comes to mind? What else could you do?
Providing good infrastructure for these services.
Okay, providing good infrastructure. And what would you? What kind of infrastructure do you think would be most important in your setting?
We provide what we call container units or to bring to remote places for delivery and treatment of sexual violence.
Okay, treatment and prevention of sexual violence.
What? Delivery.
As well as deliveries.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uganda, Lebanon, Ukraine.
Yeah, Gaza, but also Africa.
Gaza. Wow. Bless you. Yes, ma'am. Okay, I'm teaching people about family planning. Say. In what's your setting?
Nigeria.
In Nigeria. Yeah. Thank you. Who else? Has a vision. Yes?
I think one thing is to see how you can get that education out. Like for us, we've realized that radio is the best way because everybody listens to the radio every day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, trying to find out in your area what's your best way to communicate that education. You might not be able to get people to your place, but if there's some way you can communicate it to everybody who's going to hear it, it will drive them.
So the use of radio in order to spread the word for people that you might not be able to individually reach. Yes?
So again, in a lot of these communities, women don't have the decision-making power, the bargaining power. You have to get the men and the elders of the village or whatever it is, you have to make it worth it to them.
Mm-hmm.
In order for to really take off and to be adopted.
So address the men or whoever is in power, you know, in the community and help them to understand the importance of this kind of care.
And why it's good for them.
Why it's good for them, yes. Please. Yeah, use the use of community health workers as a means of spreading the word, providing this kind of education. Yes?
One of the things we did, I ran a clinic in Honduras for a while, and then we turned it over to the locals. And we made sure, one of the first things that for those women that that we either the trained midwives or the community health workers, when they started working with the mothers in the homes, and how were they going to get somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
Their plan
so
for delivery.
Addressing how? Addressing transportation.
Transportation.
And
where?
Where are you going to deliver?
And we taught them like the stages of, you know, like if it's a very young, you're not like not going to be a home birth.
If you're young, it's not going to be a home birth.
So we taught them like the different levels of like
different levels of complication,
right,
which would require different
would
kinds of care.
And to make sure that family knew those levels,
mm-hmm,
on top of it.
Sure, the family knows all this.
Yes, and then make sure they knew someone who either had an ox cart or a car or a truck that could get them where they needed to go.
Know someone who has transportation that could help.
Yeah. And so
with
all of our pregnant women, right at the beginning, we started with that, saying, "What if you have means of transportation? Are you walking?" Just that they've got it. And we could tell our workers with them that you are discipling this entire time. These women are, you're working with them and you're discipling. Pray with your women.
Pray with your women and work with them.
Yes.
See these as a discipling relationship, potentially.
Right.
That's right.
Captive audience.
Thank you so much for joining me today. My card is at the door. If you'd like to pick up a card or visit me at the NMED exhibit, I'd be happy to talk with you all. Thanks for coming. Thank you.